Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, veteran journalist and author Todd S. Purdo talks about his latest book, Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. This biography of Arnaz, an influential figure in TV and the former husband of comedian Lucille Ball, was published by Simon & Schuster in June 2025. Todd Purdo was interviewed via Zoom by fellow biographer and BIO member John, better known as Jack, Farrell.
Our guest today is Todd Purdo, the author of Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television, Something Wonderful, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Broadway Revolution, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, a gripping history of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and A Time of Our Choosing. Did I get that right, Todd?
Yeah.
About the Iraq War. So welcome, Todd. And fast question right off the bat, what drew you from current events in history to biography?
Well, it's a good question. It's a pleasure to be here, Jack. And partly it's that as an aging journalist, and given the current state of politics in America, covering politics became a lot less satisfying than it had been during my career as a journalist at the New York Times and Vanity Fair and Politico. And then in 2020, I was involuntarily liberated from my job at The Atlantic in the pandemic. So I needed to look for a project. And I had written, as you say, this joint biography, sort of critical biography of Rodgers and Hammerstein, which was published in 2018. And I was open to doing another cultural topic. And I called an old friend from college, the playwright, actor, director Doug McGrath, who sadly has since died while he was doing a one-man show off Broadway. But he'd always loved I Love Lucy. And he thought Lucille Ball, of course, was the obvious genius of the show, but that Desi Arnaz had not gotten enough credit. And you'll probably remember that in 2020, it was a moment in our culture in the wake of George Floyd and other things when we were reexamining people who perhaps had not gotten credit in their own day. The New York Times was running that overlooked series of obituaries. And I thought Desi Arnaz was a classic example of a person who was underestimated because of his funny accent and the fact that he was a second banana straight man on television. People didn't really understand his contributions to the transformation of the television industry in the 1950s. So happily, Simon Schuster agreed, and that's how I got here. So I approached Lucy Arnaz through a mutual friend, and she was very interested. But at that time, she was entangled with Amazon and Aaron Sorkin in the making of the movie that starred Nicole Kidman and Javier Bardem called Being the Ricardos. And she felt constrained from cooperating with any other project. That legal challenge ultimately got resolved, and she invited me out to her house in Palm Springs, where she keeps a very meticulously maintained kind of family archive in her air-conditioned garage. And she set me up with a table and an outlet for my laptop and said, have at it. And from that moment on, she gave me her unstinting trust while asking no approval over anything I wrote. And she's just been an incredible, generous help at every turn. And so her brother, too, Desi Arnaz Jr., in his own way, was also very, very helpful.
Yeah. I think that it's astonishing that given some of the revelations in the book about Desi and his weakness or fondness for prostitutes and the way that tore at this ostensibly a picture book marriage and some of the experiences I've had with members of families where the slightest criticism of the honored person gets you a cold stare, if not threats of legal action. It's astonishing that, and that you found somebody who was willing to sort of step back and let the chips fall where they may. Why do you think that they were like that? Is it because they're so inured to the celebrity game in California?
Yes, in some ways I think that's true, Jack. I mean, Desi Arnaz was the most famous baby in the world when he was born in 1953. He was the first cover boy of the first issue of TV Guide that spring. And I think Lucy Arnaz in particular, she's a remarkable person, first of all, and very talented in her own right. And she has spent a lot of time thinking about her parents' legacy. She's a very faithful, clear-eyed steward of their reputation, and she understands that to the rest of us, we think they belong to the world, while she's also totally aware of their human foibles as parents and people. And she made it clear from the beginning that I should tell the whole story. I asked her, I said, you know, the third act, I don't know how to handle it. She said, there's grace in the third act and just tell the truth. And that the thing that meant the most to me is when I sent her the manuscript, not for approval, but just so she could read it, she left me a long voice memo saying that she pictured her father reading it over her shoulder and saying, fair enough. And, you know, as a reporter, you're always unnerved if somebody likes something too much, because right. You think you maybe have missed the truth, and you're very disturbed if they threaten legal action or they don't like it. So I took fair enough, and I wear it like a medal, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting writing about somebody from Hollywood, given your political backing. I always tell people who ask what it's like to meet a celebrity that the two classes of people who are most adept at hiding their true selves are Hollywood actors and national politicians. Was there anything in your previous career that armed you for switching to Rodgers and Hammerstein and then to Desi and Lucy?
That's a good question, Jack. Didn't Ronald Reagan say he thought it would be impossible to be an effective president if you didn't have a little bit of an actor in you? And I mean, I think there is a sort of self-image, self-imagination. So one thing that helped me is when he came to write his autobiography in 1976, when he was on the cusp of 60, Desi had been so resentful that he didn't get the credit he felt he deserved from Hollywood, that he sometimes then took credit for things that he hadn't done alone. And he was always the hero of his own life, like, you know, David Copperfield in his memoir. And so I had a pretty good, let's just say, BS detector for where he might have gilded the lily a little bit. And also, I would say that just by being 65 years old and having been around the block a few times, I had a good sense of the self-delusion that he was under about his problems, his defensiveness about his alcoholism and his womanizing and his self-justification for it. These all were kind of the classic hallmarks of a person who's in denial. And finally, I think one of the things that my political coverage really helped me with is you and I covered a president whose flaws and strengths are all bound up with each other, Bill Clinton. That doesn't mean that his strengths are not incredibly strong. And I found that with Desi Arnaz, it was useless to ask if we could have had the best of him without having the self-destructive parts of him, because they're all part of the same package, and the drives that affect one benefit the other. So I think in some ways, it's partly covering politics and partly living life that made me, you know, and I don't know how you feel, but as I get older, in general, I'm just a lot less willing to cast judgment. I feel like I have better discernment about things, but I'm less willing to hurl thunderbolts about.
Yeah. And of course, you are also one half of a Hollywood power couple. And do you at all understand a little bit more about Lucy and Desi from being married to Didi and having your life exposed with two really pretty good actors on the West Wing?
Yes, I think I have a definite appreciation. You know, whenever you've been written about, you don't feel that it's ever really quite right. So I think as a very minor, semi-hemi-demi public figure at times in my life, I'm sensitive to how people can get things wrong or miss the emphasis. And I also, you know, from Dee Dee's years working at Warner Brothers as director of communications at the studio, I came to understand quite a bit about the way the television business worked. And I was able to talk to some senior television executives and entertainment professionals who could explain to me their view of Desi's impact and particularly of the impact on television of filming a situation comedy live with three cameras in front of a studio audience, which gives an enormous sense of energy to the production. All those things were helpful, yes.
I thought that chapter when they first get to the studio and he is going through all these innovations was spectacular, because in much the same way that you enabled me to understand a Broadway musical with Something Wonderful, I understood a little bit more about the challenge of putting together a sitcom and what the three cameras did.
Well, I thank you, Jack. Arts is a very collaborative process. It's not unlike politics in that way. And basically what happened was, instead of using a single camera the way most movies are filmed, where you take one shot of a person and then you get a close-up and you have a long shot and you have a reaction shot for comedy, that loses spontaneity. So together with other experts, it wasn't Desi alone, they resolved that they would film I Love Lucy with three cameras running at once so they could capture the action and reaction at the same time and then edit the film together in a seamless way. And that became very quickly the industry model for how sitcoms should be done and persists largely to this day. I mean, there have been exceptions. And in the 1960s, particularly, there was a period where there were a lot of single camera sitcoms. But really, with All in the Family in 1971, Norman Lear believed strongly that you should have the audience reaction and treat the whole thing like a play. And that revived the practice of doing this. And even today, the movie director Paul Feig, who's famous for Bridesmaids and those other raucous comedies, he says he likes to shoot with multiple cameras, even though it's a lot harder for the cameramen to do the setup, because you capture lightning in a bottle with the joke. And if improvisation happens, you can capture it. You can very seldom recreate it if you have to then move the cameras to a different place, set up a completely different angle, lose the moment. And it's also one of the reasons why we can enjoy I Love Lucy on this pristine film almost 75 years later.
Again, I had no idea that there would be resistance to the idea that you would be filming in California instead of New York, and that the solution to that would be to turn to a different media, and that very quickly that technical problem was solved for everybody, but that Desi said, no, we're going to do it this way, and if it means that we're going to use film rather than, what was that called, kinetoscope?
Well, yeah, I mean, you would just, in that time, there was no videotape yet, so television was almost completely a live medium. The signal was beamed out into the airwaves and lost forever, unless you filmed a cruddy image off a video monitor called a kinescope, usually on 16 millimeter film, and it was very poor quality and nothing could be done to improve it. And so CBS said, we do not want the eastern two-thirds of the country to see a show, because you couldn't send a broadcast signal all the way across the country either. There wasn't yet a coaxial transcontinental cable or a method of transmitting the signal across the whole country. So really, these were inventions born of necessity, and they had the effect of transforming the industry. For one thing, it meant that most television content would soon be filmed, and that Los Angeles, and not New York, would become the center of television production. Television had started in New York because it was a sponsor-driven medium, not a ticket-driven medium. And so the sponsors, the advertising agencies, were based in New York overwhelmingly. And really, Desi was part of the cadre of early television executives who were responsible for moving the whole industry to LA, where it remains.
And of course, he didn't live to reap all the amazing financial benefits, but by keeping the rights to the show to himself, he opened a door to the riches of reruns.
Yes. And then ultimately, he sold the show back to CBS and used that nest egg to invest and buy the old RKO studios in Hollywood, making his and Lucy's company, Desi Lu Productions, the largest producer of television content in the world by the end of the 1950s. Now, part of the paradox and the poignancy of this all is that at the height of his success, Desi was undermined by his alcohol problem, and ultimately Lucy bought him out of the company and he had a premature sort of forced retirement at the age of 45. But he was a visionary in terms of understanding what we see today in Hollywood. If you own the, you know, IP, if you control the intellectual property, you are king of the hill. And he instinctively knew that having the ownership of those films would be vitally valuable to him and to Lucy going forward.
And some of the early franchises that grew from that was The Untouchables and Twilight Zone. Later on, we had Mission Impossible and Star Trek, but that would have been after his time?
That's after Lucy bought him out. But the last two pilots that Lucy approved as president of Desilu, her business advisors told her that if you greenlight these shows, they will be cash flow negative and very expensive to produce, and any yield will come down the line, and you will have to sell the company. But she and her second husband, particularly Gary Morton, liked the shows, and she approved them. And then the next year, she sold the studio to Paramount. And let's just say that Mission Impossible and Star Trek have been multi-billion dollar franchises for Paramount Pictures ever since.
There was a lot of talent in that family.
There was a lot of talent in the family. And it's funny because Desi had grown up a very wealthy, privileged child in Cuba. His family fled in 1933 after the American-backed regime of Gerardo Machado was overthrown, came to Florida with nothing in his pockets, and reinvented himself. He was on track to go to Notre Dame and maybe be a lawyer and part of the Cuban aristocracy, and his life changed completely in his teenage years, putting on my amateur shrink hat for a minute. I think he almost certainly would have suffered from what we would now call undiagnosed trauma or unprocessed childhood trauma. And it's part of what gave him a risk-taking propensity. He'd lost everything, so he was willing to chance anything. But it's also part of what haunted him and led him to seek release in alcohol and other things. And I think that's one of the sad realities of his life, is that the very same experiences that made him such a high achiever also made him suffer, and he paid the price for it.
When you were bouncing this idea around with Doug or with Didi, were you thinking at all that this connects to the debate over immigration and the place of Hispanic people in our culture?
Not so much, because the immigration debate, while it was bubbling along, it wasn't quite so intense then. It's really the feeling that the border got so out of control during the Biden administration that brought it back to the foreground. It was bubbling along, no doubt about it. But one of the things that I was fascinated to realize is that Desi came here from Cuba on some kind of a visitor or temporary visa, but he started working as playing in a band in a hotel in Miami Beach without the proper papers. And one day an immigration officer came by and said, you know, you should not be working, but I'm going to take pity on you and give you a break, and you can go back to Cuba. I'll give you 3 months and you can get an order and get in line for permanent residency. And that's what Desi did. And he said in his memoir, you know, it just goes to show you there are some good people in the world. So as I was finishing the book, I certainly thought to myself, you know, where out there in America today are there some young person with a dream who might not be here with every legal authority and probably isn't going to find the sympathetic immigration officer that Desi Arnaz found? Desi was a conservative Republican who felt always grateful to America. He was incredibly patriotic. And it's a real question, you know, it's something that's been on my mind a lot.
Yeah. There's a great line in the book about Lucy. And it talks about the pain of a clown. Was it Dorothy Kilgallen who said it? Am I getting that right?
Maybe, but it was also one of her childhood friends talking about how Lucy had had a lot. I mean, her father died before she was 4 years old. She was shunted around among a bunch of relatives. She had a pretty hard childhood in ways. There was love, but there was also a lot of dislocation. And to the end of her life, the only thing that ever really brought her satisfaction was terribly hard work. And when she was retired, after her last series ended in 1974, well, her last successful series, Here's Lucy, she had a comeback attempt in 1986, just as Desi was dying, actually, that got canceled on ABC. But she was frustrated. I think she spent the last years of her life successful economically and collecting lifetime achievement awards, but in some ways bored stiff and wishing she could go back to work, and she couldn't.
Yeah, she was tough.
One tough lady, no doubt about it.
Yeah. So the dedication to Something Wonderful goes to your parents for teaching you the songs?
Yes, I mean, to my parents for teaching me these songs, and for Didi and my children for making my heart sing them. And my parents, my father's older brother was an actor in New York. They would go to New York when I was a kid for, you know, 7 days and come home with 8 playbills. And my sister and I would pore over them and listen to the original cast albums of the great Broadway musicals of the 60s. I still think about, you know, how in one trip in 1964, they saw Zero Mostel and Fiddler on the Roof, Carol Channing and Hello Dolly, and Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl, and probably several other things as well. So I fell in love with that. That was kind of the soundtrack of my life. And as you know, I got slotted into being a political reporter at the New York Times. And I love that. And I love history. I love politics. But whenever I could at the Times, I would moonlight writing about culture or pop culture. And especially when I was the Los Angeles bureau chief in the late 90s, early 2000s, took every chance I could to write about entertainment. And so I've always had that itch, and now I'm, I guess, scratching it.
Well, you always seem to me like you had a little bit of Nick Carraway or F. Scott in you coming from the Midwest. You grew up near Peoria, am I right?
Yeah, a town called Macomb, Illinois, about 250 miles from Chicago, 80 miles from Peoria. And I went to school and worked in the East until I came to California to live in 1997, and then been back and forth to Washington a couple times.
So has that helped you, that Midwestern perspective?
I do think so. I mean, it's a cliche about Midwestern personality, but I think it helped me in politics because I always remembered what life in my hometown was like. I have a lot of cousins and childhood friends who are strong supporters of President Trump. So, you know, I have some understanding of the appeal that he has. I think some of my colleagues who maybe have grown up more completely on one coast or the other don't have that same background. And I don't feel jaded. I mean, I'm still very excited to go cover Congress or go to the White House. And I'm excited to go to a movie premiere or walk around the soundstage of a studio. It's all very interesting. I try not to get bored. It's like life is too short to be bored or to be super sophisticated. I mean, I'm a kind of, I would have to say, a sort of enthusiast.
Yeah. So you said anyway that a couple of times in the book and just now that Doug helped you through what, a period of artistic reinvention or
Well, yeah, I mean, I was very depressed to lose my job at The Atlantic. I'd never lost a job before. It was very sudden. It happened in the middle of, a global pandemic when life was upended anyway, and our children were home from school, and life was in a kind of a strange thing. And Doug was just very generous, and he had a lot of faith in it. And I should add that not everybody did have faith in this idea in the beginning. And my longtime publisher, to whom I had to offer it, rejected it, misspelling my name in the process. And my agent was decidedly not enthusiastic about it. But ultimately, the proposal found its way to Mindy Marquez at Simon & Schuster, who had recently joined the publishing house after many years as the executive editor of the Miami Herald. And it turned out that her parents are from Santiago de Cuba, Desi's hometown. And she had grown up in Florida and New York and instantly understood, as did her boss, Priscilla Payton, the executive editor of Simon & Schuster, the appeal of this. And it's really an example of the difference that difference makes when gatekeepers reflect the diversity of our country. And that's another lesson about Desi. I mean, Desi was mocked and looked askance at by CBS and the sponsors. People thought that the public wouldn't accept him as the wife of this redheaded all-American girl. And he knew that the public was ahead of the suits and the decision makers. And I think it's an important lesson for us all to remember today that yes, there might be excesses in diversity, equity, inclusion in academia and other places, but the country's strength is its diversity. And I think most of the country is proud of that. Talent comes in all kinds of shapes and sizes and all kinds of packages. And Desi is a real lesson about that.
Did you ever consider doing them both?
Lucy has been written about very extensively and quite well by a number of people. And Lucy was the first person to the end of her life to say that Desi deserved the lion's share of the credit for getting the show on the air and keeping it going. And so I really wanted to kind of rebalance the scales a bit.
Has a lot been written about the making of the first show?
The First I Love Lucy
I love
show?
Lucy, yeah.
Yeah, there are a couple of good books about the history of the show in general. And yes, a fair amount has been written about how that all came together, but I was able to find some new material. And one of the things that was a big help is that Lucy Arnaz in 1993 or four made a documentary herself based on her parents' home movies. But she also interviewed virtually everybody who'd been a creative collaborator of theirs, almost all of whom are now gone. And she saved the transcripts of those interviews, not all of which made it into the finished film. And she shared those with me too. So essentially, I was able to have interviews with people from, beyond the grave who could talk about being there when the whole thing started.
And to the listeners, Todd passes on that generosity. The transcripts of his interviews were a huge help for me. The ones at the Dirksen Center, I understand you have another set at Princeton. And when I was doing the civil rights chapter on my Ted Kennedy book, not only was your book helpful, but there I could go and follow in your footsteps and read the actual interviews themselves for questions that applied more to me than to others. So just kudos to you and a thanks for that, Todd.
Well, we all have to stick together. And some of those interviews, in fact, had been given to me by our old friend Adam Clymer, who initially thought about writing a book about the Civil Rights Act and the Republican role in passing it. So many hands make light work.
Okay, so part of the audience for the podcast is young biographers or people coming into biography for the first time, fledgling biographers in different ways. So you got this idea, you think it's going to be Desi, then you go out and you look and see the smorgasbord of stuff that's out there about this famous couple. How do you sort of keep that in mind and get the freedom to plunder the best, knowing that it's going to only add to your eventual product?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, one of the things you try to do is find all the published books you can. I've always found it very important to try to find whatever primary sources you can. And in this case, I was lucky with Lucy's family documents. Also, there are about 80 odd scrapbooks in the Library of Congress, some of which are in Spanish, compiled by Desi's father about his own political career in Cuba and Desi's career. And I got a classmate of our son's at Georgetown, who's a native Spanish speaker, Cuban American, who went and researched those for me since I took 8 years of high school and college French. So you look for the source material, you look for all the published things you can find, you try to figure out how you can make a difference, what you can add, what you can bring that will be new and fresh. And to me, the classic example of this is John Meacham's book about Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. I think I would have bet against that book haven't those two guys been written about, an awful lot? But the way that John tightened the lens and looked at their friendship and their relationship in a very narrow way made the whole thing seem incredibly vivid and fresh. I like to hope as a journalist that if you make a pass through the archive and a pass through the published material with your own sensibility, your own fresh set of eyes, you might see things other people haven't. And of course, the cultural context in which you're writing changes all the time. So I don't think I would have written the same kind of book about Desi Arnaz 30 years ago as I wrote now. And as you know well, the most fun part about writing narrative nonfiction or history is that you know how it came out, but the actors at the time did not know that, they were going to win the war or lose the battle or whatever. And part of your challenge as a writer is to make that all come alive vividly for the reader and place them back in the moment in history where nobody knew. And that's fun.
Yeah. So, do you have a next project you want to talk about?
Norman Lear's widow, Lynn, has very generously granted me first crack at his archive. So I just came back yesterday from my third day in a dusty storage facility in North Hollywood, California, looking through the first of about 1,400 boxes. But Norman, whom I came to know a little bit in my time in LA, in many ways did for television in the 1970s, transformed it in the comparable way that Desi had in the 1950s. In Norman's case, it was to make the sitcom come of age by facing topical issues and sensitive subjects. And then the last third of Norman's life, he was very, very active in politics and public affairs and public advocacy. And so if this works out right, and I can persuade a publisher to buy it, it will combine all of my interests in pop culture, entertainment, and politics and government. And it seems like it could easily occupy me for quite some time to come, sadly.
That sounds great. I heartily endorse it. And to wrap up, do you ever find that the subjects of your biographies show up in your dreams?
I don't know that Desi has shown up in my dreams. He certainly occupies my waking thoughts. People ask me if I like him, and the answer is I like him a lot. And sometimes I want to smack him across the face, and I've been exasperated by him. But I really wish I had been able to know him. Same with Rodgers and Hammerstein. They were very compelling figures. And it's a good question. It's like someone asked Helen Keller if she closed her eyes when she fell asleep. She said, "I don't know. I never stayed awake to find out." So I don't know, but it's a good question.
Okay. Thanks, Todd. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was veteran journalist and author Todd S. Purdom speaking with Bio member John A. Farrell about his latest book, Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. It was published by Simon & Schuster in June 2025, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in July of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.